Back together again, you and I, Thursday, January 26th, 2023, on Connecticut Today. We feature news of a proposed bill out of Hartford to put possible new limits on window tinting allowed on Connecticut motor vehicles. Wallingford and Middlefield GOP State Rep. Craig Fischbein chatted with us about Governor Ned Lamont's latest gun safety proposals. And Southern Connecticut State University Associate Professor of Political Science and Urban Affairs, Dr. Jonathan Wartner, returned. He talked about his personal experience handling classified documents when he worked as a staff member in Congress. And we begin. Hey, how are you, folks? Thank you, Mr. Big Voice there. Appreciate that. We begin with one of my favorite topics to talk about. I've touched on it numerous times here on this show because it makes me laugh, and there are some things that are so obvious when you talk about it, you have to laugh at what we see every day. Now, am I talking about taxes? No. The Bridgeport mayor's race? No. Gun control? No. We'll talk about those coming up in the show, by the way, later on. Abortion? No. Although the Democrats in Hartford, we'll get to that later on, too. They want to make, like, you know, abortion access here in Connecticut like a drive-up restaurant. Come on in, ma'am. Just pull your car over here. So we'll talk about that coming up later. No, we begin today on this Thursday, January 26th, 2023. We begin with window tint. Yes, one of my favorite topics. Because how many of us, I mean, come on, seriously, I'm not kidding here. How many of us drive around during the day coming or going to work and or going to run errands or picking the kids up from school or the grandkids up from school or going out at night to a nice dinner, whatever, late dinner, early happy hour, whatever. And we see a car right next to us, pulled up next to us at a stop sign or a stop light or driving next to us. And you look and you say to yourself, how in the hell can anybody see out of that car? How can the driver see out of that car? Especially if there's the, you know, what they call limo tint. I mean, the real dark tint that cuts down on almost all the passable light coming through the, you know, coming through the windows. And we look at it and we say, well, yeah, all right, whatever. But you see more and more of this tint, right? And you say to yourself, well, you know, you look at certain vehicles and you say to yourself in certain areas of town, listen, I'm not saying anything that nobody out there has ever thought. So let's just lay it on the table there. You know, there's certain levels of tint on certain levels of vehicle that you say to yourself, well, there's somebody who doesn't want the cops to see their face, right? I mean, it's patently obvious. Now, I do know, before you jump up my backside here, which would really be unpleasant for both of us, before you jump up my backside here at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC, there can, in fact, be, and I looked this up early this morning and to see how many reasons there are, there very well can be medical reasons for you to need window tinting. Yes, I mean, you know, from you may have been a skin cancer survivor or maybe very light of skin. Your dermatologist may say, get some tinting because, you know, if you're driving in the middle of the day, I don't want your arms and your face and your neck to get a melanoma or a squamous cell cancer, whatever. So, you know, there are cancer concerns there. There are excess sunlight, UV radiation concerns if you're on certain medications. Certain allergies, believe it or not, can exacerbate a bad reaction to UV rays, to sunlight. Apparently now I learned this today that if you are a person with lupus, and I do know a couple of people, one in my condo building in a longtime compatriot I used to work with in radio, if you have lupus, autoimmune disease, there are concerns about you being in the direct sun. So, yes, there are medical reasons very well documented for you to get a certain level of window tint that may be right near or different than the state standard, which is like 35% of effective light has to pass through it. Okay, we know that. So, yes, there are reasons, viable, verifiable, legitimate reasons for somebody to tint out their windows. And then there are the people that don't want to be seen by the cops. And then there are the people that pull up next to you and you look over and you say, geez, is that, I couldn't tell if that person is looking at me, is threatening me, is laughing at me, or maybe pointing a gun at me. Now, you just can't, right? You just look. I'm not saying anything that you haven't thought about. And let's face it, there are people in heavily tinted cars that want to keep a low profile from the police. We all know that. Come on, we weren't born yesterday. We know what this is about. Well, there is a Democratic lawmaker. Why am I starting with this, Paul? What's the point? Well, I'll tell you why. Because there's a Democratic lawmaker in Hartford that wants to severely cut back on how a car can be tinted. And I'm surprised this came from a Democrat. And it's starting to get some. Now, again, let me just say, as Al Gore used to say, let me just say, we're all going to die in 10 years. This bill may not even make it out of committee, but it's interesting that it has been at least proposed, and it's already causing a little bit of a rumble there of worry. It's got picked up by a couple of websites today around the state. Our buddy Tom Dudchick has this on the Capitol Report, which is where I saw it, and it got picked up by a organization called, I guess, a trade publication. Or a trade site, you know, a lot of shops will do this window tinting for you. Window Film Magazine. I believe it or not, there is Window Film Magazine. Go to Window Film Mag, M-A-G, windowfilmmag.com. Haven't checked whether there's a centerfold or whatever, but Window Film Magazine. Connecticut Senate Bill 586 concerns the industry and the association. This was posted late yesterday, so it's kind of starting to make waves today. The International Window Film Association, I didn't know something like that exists, but it apparently does, has sent out an alert to its members, sent out an alert concerning Connecticut State Senate Bill 586, which was introduced actually 8 days ago, January the 18th. If passed, now get this, SB 586 would prohibit the installation of any transparent material on the front windshield or on the front side windows of any motor vehicle. Now, that's interesting. Now, you don't often see window tinting on the front windshield. Sometimes you do. I've seen completely blacked out windows all around the car, all around, except for a little cutout where the drug dealer who's driving, where the gang member who's driving can barely see, but the cops, nobody else can see in there. So apparently, says here, current Connecticut law permits window film on the front side windows. So in other words, the left side, front seat, driver side left, and passenger side right. The visible light standard for front side windows in Connecticut is 35%. In other words, it's got to let through. I don't know how this standard works, actually. Is that 35% minimum that it goes through or can only cut down 35%? I don't know. That is, Connecticut law permits the application of window film to restrict light entering a vehicle in order to promote the health and safety of Connecticut drivers and vehicle occupants. And that's why some tinting is allowed, because you may have an allergy, you may have lupus, you may have been a skin cancer survivor or have a high probability for skin cancer. So they don't like this. The window tinting folks in Connecticut don't like this. It's been referred to the Transportation Committee. It is sponsored by a Democrat, State Senator Rick Lopes. Now, there have been no hearings scheduled for the bill. So, in other words, maybe the senator did this as a constituent service because somebody said, hey, can you do this? And see what happens. Alopes is a Democrat, Berlin, New Britain, and parts of Farmington. No others have signed on to the bill here. So what do you think of this? You know me. I have, unless it's a medical reason, to me, sitting here, unless you have a medical reason, there's no reason for you to have window tinting on your car. There isn't. I'm sorry. There's no reason. I should be able to see you. Well, no, Paul, you shouldn't. It's my private vehicle. Stop that argument. It's a public thoroughfare. It's a public road. I should be able to see you. There's no reason you have to hide from me unless you are dealing drugs and I'm the cops. So what do you think of this? Do you like this idea? Now, it doesn't completely get rid of window tinting in film. All it says is that it would prohibit the installation of any transparent material on the front windshield, which makes sense. You shouldn't have any tinting on the front windshield. I'm sorry, unless you have a medical reason. Unless you have a medical reason. Why do you need window tint for? Well, I don't like the sunlight coming in my car. Wear sunglasses. Isn't that what they make them for? If passed, the bill would prohibit the installation of any transparent material on the front windshield or on the front side windows of any motor vehicle. Oh, some people wouldn't like that because they want to hide what they're doing from the police. We know that. All right, Pete in Milford, Ken in Bridgeport, hang on, we'll be to you. What do you think of this? Should we cut way back on this window tinting stuff? This probably won't go anywhere. The urban legislators will never vote for this, but it is interesting. Again, you want tinting? You want window tinting? Fine, get a doctor's note. And I'm all for you. If you got skin cancer, if you're a survivor, if you have lupus, if you're taking, you know, certain medications, by the way, for things like arthritis and what else? Eczema, sometimes they cut down your resistance to UV rays. I get that. But just to roll around where I can't see, if you're pointing something at me, sorry. And we continue right here on Connecticut Today, WICC 600 AM, 107.3 FM, and online at WICC600.com. A lot to talk about, of course, a lot of controversy surrounding the latest set of gun safety proposals, as has been designated by Democrats and Governor Ned Lamont. Joining us right now is a gentleman who knows the gun laws very, very well. He's also the ranking member on the General Assembly's Judiciary, the top-ranking Republican there, State Rep. Craig Fishbein, who's been on the program numerous times before representing Wallingford and Cheshire. Craig, hi there once again. How are you?
Howdy, Paul. Long time no see, but I listen to you all the time.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So apparently the check cleared, and I appreciate that, Craig. Thank you so much. All right. A lot of things, a few bullet points, no pun intended, rolled out by the governor yesterday, or the other day, rather. Give me your overall impressions of this before we go point by point here. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, the governor comes out with representatives from our major cities, you know, stating there's gun crime in the cities, and this is part of a package to address this. You know, most of it doesn't address anything having to do with the cities. You know, that's the initial overview, you know, banning open carry. I don't see a proliferation of open carrying people, never mind in our cities, even in our towns. So that just seems like an anti-gun proposal. Banning the prohibiting the carrying in bars. Well, if I'm going to a bar and I'm going to have a soda, which, you know, I can't remember the last time I drank alcohol. But anyway, you know, why shouldn't I be able to carry if law enforcement has permitted me to be able to carry? Once again, there's absolutely nothing about the proliferation of gun crimes in our cities.
So let's talk, Craig, about, I guess, what is being proposed here on a somewhat bigger scale, the purchase limits for guns here, and also this constant controversy about what is or what isn't a ghost gun. I had Holly Sullivan on the other day from CCDL, and she pointed out that, yeah, these ghost guns exist, but by and large, this may affect a lot of people who are gunsmiths, who make guns, and the whole crackdown on ghost guns, while sounding good, may not solve a problem either. What are your thoughts on that?
So, you know, dealing with the bulk purchases, the governor says this would prevent straw purchases. The governor claims that certain individuals go and, you know, purchase a few firearms, then they go and sell them to other individuals. And that's traditionally, that's under our law, what is known as a straw purchase. Unfortunately, there's no basis for the governor's assertion. We already have laws in place to ostensibly protect from that happening. The governor claims that when a firearm is found at a scene of a crime, let's say, or someone else's possession, they go back to the owner and the owner says, well, it was stolen. Okay, well, we already have a law that says if your gun was lost or stolen, you're supposed to report that to the police within 72 hours. You're learning it was lost or stolen, or you should have learned it was lost or stolen. The first offense is an infraction. Any subsequent is a felony. So, you know, the police go to someone and say, well, you know, your gun was found at John Smith's house, and, you know, he's a prohibited person. How did it get to John Smith's house? Well, you know, on the first occasion, you may be able to say it was stolen and I didn't report it. And there's a penalty for that. But, you know, if you do it again, it's a felony. So bulk purchases doesn't prevent anything but law-abiding people from being able to purchase a firearm. So, you know, moving on to the ghost gun situation, it's presently illegal for somebody who is a prohibited person to be in possession of an instrument that could shoot a bullet, a firearm. So if somebody who is, let's say, a convicted felon, builds a gun and doesn't have a serial number, and therefore it's a ghost gun, they are committing a felony. If I make a gun, AKA ghost gun, and try to transfer it to you, Paul, that transaction has to be approved by the state police. Otherwise, it is a felony already. So, you know, I understand ghost gun, you know, it's a cute phrase. It's a scary phrase, all that stuff. But we already have laws in place to protect against that from happening. And, you know, and criminals don't follow gun laws. I hate to, you know, mention it, but that's actually the truth.
You know, Craig, I got into a pretty interesting discussion with callers the other day and a former state rep, and people are wondering, Craig, to what extent, and let me ask you this, if you can kind of summarize this for us, with all these laws and all these misdemeanors and felonies that we read about and hear about every day, how forcefully, maybe that's the word, are gun cases prosecuted and followed through in this state? Maximum sentences, plea bargains. Give me your thoughts on that.
Well, we did get a report. It was last March on the adjudication of gun crimes, and it was staggering to me the number of them that are actually nollied. And what a nollie means is that it's not a conviction. It's a basically the file is left over for 13 months as long as you don't do anything else. At the end of the 13 months, the case goes away. It was dismissed. You know, there's a significant number of criminal possession of a firearm cases that fall within that category, and that particular charge gets nollied. Now, as to whether or not there were additional charges in any particular case that did get prosecuted, and, you know, I can understand sometimes the facts don't bear out being able to prove someone guilty beyond a reasonable doubt on everything they are arrested for. On gun crimes in particular, a lot of them are nullied.
All right, let's move here in the couple of minutes we have left, Craig, to marijuana. I had Dave Rattigliano on, one of your caucus members from Trumbull yesterday, and I know he and all of your other folks in the Republican caucus, and from what I understand, even a few Democrats on the other side may be looking at trying to tighten things up. Listen, marijuana sales have started. We know that. They're selling at the medical marijuana dispensaries. The private sellers aren't online yet. But I know there are some concerns, Craig, about a potency, about child safety packaging. What are your thoughts on that? And are you optimistic that maybe, you know, some of these things, you know, like NFL coaches say after a post game, can be cleaned up in the current session? What do you think?
Yeah, you know, many times that is the case. A lot of the stuff that we had foretold in our opposition to the overall, and I'm going to use air finger quotes, legalization of marijuana, because actually Connecticut, no state can legalize marijuana, really. You know, many of those things have come true. The packaging is an issue, and it's also a gray area. You know, when does a package look similar to a box of Cocoa Puffs or something like that, or Pop Rocks, or you know, something that was enticing to a child? It's very subjective. But, you know, one of my focus areas has been in the context of police enforcement. Mm-hmm. You know, as part of that bill, if a police officer saw you drinking a beer while you are operating a motor vehicle, under our law, they can pull you over. But as part of the marijuana law, if they saw you or perceived you to be smoking a joint, they cannot pull you over, you know, based solely upon that. And the concern becomes, what if there's four kids in a car? So, you know, we understand that the developmental brain and all that stuff prior to 18, it's a harmful substance. So now you've got, what do they call it? Not wake and bake. There's a cliche term for it. they're actually in I can't remember what it is.
All right.
But, you know, in a closed container where everybody, you know, one person's smoking and then everybody else is ingesting.
Well, sure, yeah.
And they all get stoned, right? But right now, under our law, if a police officer saw that activity, they can't pull that motor vehicle over. That's troubling. And that's a cleanup that, you know, we are going to be talking about this session. I have spoken to my Democratic colleagues about that, and they are certainly sympathetic to that. So it's unfortunate that the passage of this very lengthy law has led to an experiment to a certain extent in our communities, necessitating cleanups.
Greg Fishbein, Republican state rep, portions of Wallingford and Cheshire. He is the ranking member on Judiciary, bringing us up to date with his assessment and the caucus's assessment of the gun proposals and what can be done, hopefully, to tighten up the marijuana laws a little bit here in the state. Craig, always good to hear from you. Take care, and we shall talk down the road. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We've been hearing over and over and over again about the discovery, apparently accidentally, not the Trump case, because he knew what he had, but from Vice President Mike Pence, from current President Joe Biden, back when he was in Congress and as VP, of what they call classified documents. They try not to get too specific here, but classified documents. And now CNN reporting today that the National Archives is basically telling every surviving president and vice president, hey, can you just kind of, you know, go through your papers and send us stuff that you may have? Well, this next gentleman is a regular guest here on the show, and being a congressional staffer at one time, he wrote a piece recently for the Connecticut Post talking about what that was like, what they were told when he was in D.C. about handling classified documents and all that. Dr. Jonathan Wharton, Associate Professor of Political Science and Urban Affairs at Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven. John, hi, it's Paul again. Good afternoon. How are you?
Paul, great talking with you, and thanks for reaching out. Well, timely topic.
Yeah, so for people, John, who may have not have seen your column the other day, they may know because we've talked before, you were a congressional staffer at one time. So give us a little insight, John, and I know there are different levels of security, but classified documents, what do you have to go through to be given access to that, even if you're a staff member?
Well, even if you're a staff member, you know, ahead of time, you have to get some kind of at least level clearances, and you know, ahead of time. If you're going to be one of the first eyes on it, that's got to be cleared through other people. Once that goes through the process, then you still got to be briefed on how you're going to be handling the paperwork, whether you can copy it, not copy it, how you distribute it, when you can distribute it. A lot of it requires prior clearances even before viewing. And so, in truth, you get briefed on all this by experts and officials in the process of this. And I should also say, as you, in the op-ed, as I emphasize, as researchers, you do the same thing as the National Archives.
So who comes in here, John? Do they sit you down in a room and say, okay, welcome to the Capitol, you're new here, here's the deal. We ran the background check, you're okay, you passed everything in the background. So are there specific areas, John, that you can look at this stuff? Is some stuff more sensitive than the other? Do you have to give the stuff back right away? I'm fascinated with this. Talk about that.
So, you know, depending on where you are, if you are a staffer, you do receive, let's say, the higher end clearances, then you might be one of the first eyes to do it. And so it's a matter of making certain you keep the papers remaining there in your office in a certain safe space or place. It's got to be at least there, right? It's one of those things where certain staffers in certain places can keep certain papers. I mean, they really try to confine it and limit it. Yeah. Yeah. So the fewer people, the better. It's more the way that I said. Now, with presidential documents and papers that have been clearances, it might be a generation, let's say 20 years later, that have already been cleared out. That's when researchers and, you know, people who do a lot of the actual analysis can view it later after it's already been, you know, pre-cleared.
Interesting. So if you're, say, in the office of a member of Congress or the Senate, and you are entrusted with writing a floor speech that your senator or congressman has to give in the coming days, obviously you can't divulge anything in the papers, but you can read them for background. So there is stuff that may have to stay there. You cannot, for example, I'm going to take it back to my apartment and work on it tonight. I would imagine there's stuff that can't even leave that area, right?
As a staffer, it's very much certain that even keeping it on your desk
really
is a concern. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I mentioned there, I was, you know, involved with a subcommittee on Homeland Security. Even keeping it somewhere, you know, where it could be noticeable on your desk or even within it, you have to keep it very much in a specific place and that, you know, your colleagues and others are aware of where those documents are. You have to be very careful with this kind of material.
A few more minutes to one of our regular contributors. He also blogs at the Connecticut News Junkie, and occasionally one of his pieces gets picked up by the Hearst people. He did the other day a great piece about how he, Dr. Jonathan Wharton from Southern Connecticut State University, used to have access. He had the proper clearance and was dealing with classified documents, as many other congressional staffers do. You know, John, it's no secret that the Trump documents, I mean, there are a lot of documents there. He was going back and forth, and his lawyers, you know, with the National Archives for months. But the Pence and the Biden thing, a lot of people are kind of postulating here, John, that, yeah, they clear out their offices. Maybe they forget certain things there, and staffers go in and just scoop up stuff and put it in a box. Now, that doesn't make it right, but can you see that as a scenario here?
Yeah, I've been reading some of that because I've been a bit curious. I should say, or even offer your listeners, sometimes when it comes to executive-level clearances, it might be a little different, let's say, than maybe even legislative branch, right? Because there are different protocols, as a matter of fact. There's some oversight powers and abilities which Congress has that maybe the executive has, and they can kind of stretch out some differences there. So I guess I could see some of that in recognizing that when it comes to the National Archives and knowing what has already been, let's say, clearance or not clearance, that you have at least that kind of final decision-making between the staffers and certainly the president making some of those decisions. But the fact that this goes back to the vice presidency of Biden, let alone his senatorial years, that should be also a cause for concern, too, that this is a pattern beyond even his current presidency.
Yeah, and John, people are saying now that if anything good comes out of this, you know, that famous phrase we use now, teachable moment, you know, we need to, do you think maybe we need to, I don't know, improve the system? Like, let me ask you, when you were back in Congress and you were looking at some of these documents, did they ever say to you, okay, John, you have this, but you have to return this by X, or if you're going to keep it, please check in and let us still know you're using it? Is there any sort of a system like that?
Well, no, you'd have to be in a specific place. And so it wasn't even a matter that, you know, you'd keep the documents around anywhere. It was specific and designated. And again, you had to have those pre-clearances to do that anyway. Look, I will say this. I think the Congress, at least from what I remember in clerking on a subcommittee there, they were pretty effective at doing something like that. I mean, even I had my limitations as a staffer. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the executive branch, that is sometimes more difficult. And so it will require probably some additional oversight and some decision making. And by the way, not just executive branches or the agencies, but I would also add Congress especially. They're going to have to find a way to get in there and recognize, what do we do to prevent these kinds of things from happening in the first place?
Yeah, because you have a scenario here with Mr. Biden and Mr. Trump and Mr. Pence. I mean, when they leave, so all this stuff was admittedly at their private homes. And I'm reading today that President Biden only consented, I think CNN reported, that he only consented to a search when the FBI and the other agency said, well, if you don't consent, Mr. President, we're going to get a search warrant. That could have been a little embarrassing.
Well, right. And there were constant delays for his part with Donald Trump. And that was exactly the concern. When the lawyers got in the middle of it, of course, I mentioned that, you know, that's when they required at least a mediator to get in the middle of this in terms of figuring out, you know, when and how the papers could be distributed back to the archives. Because it's required by law. The presidents have to, you know, submit their clearance documents, including some of those briefs.
John, I want to ask you before we separate today, before we wrap this up, I want to ask you, you said you helped out Subcommittee Homeland Security. What are your thoughts from a political point of view on what we are seeing in D.C. now, especially with Kevin McCarthy, who put his foot down pretty decisively the other day to a couple of reporters where they were pushing him on why, you know, Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell were not on Homeland Security. And he cited security issues. You know, one of them had that little dalliance with whoever turned out to be a Chinese spy. There are allegations that Adam Schiff lied about what he really knew about the Hunter Biden laptop. What are your thoughts on that, having been in that aura of the House?
Well, that's not surprising. Sometimes political leaders, especially when they're new, they will tend to weaponize or, you know, use some kind of political leverage over somebody in the opposing party. So I'm not shocked at that. It's kind of a political power move, if you will. It's some, you know, power flexing that we're seeing right now that the Republicans are utilizing even among Democrats. This is only the beginning, Paul. You know, we'll wait. Come back and talk to me in like 6 months.
All right. All right. So, John, wait a minute. If I come back to you in 6 months, so let's see, that would be July 26th. All right. Here's the big one we're going to wrap up on, John. I saved the tough one for last. Is George Santos still in Congress in 6 months?
Oh, you had to bring up George Santos. That came out of left field.
John, you can vote present on this one if you want to.
I can vote president. Let me say this. I'll end on this one at least, Paul. Let's see what happens.
Okay.
I think more things will come out of this. I think we've only seen the beginning of this, and I know there's got to be more. I think everybody wants to know. If you notice, I've not made many comments out there about the George Santos situation. I don't want to, because I'm certain that there's probably more out there we don't know about.
And, John, you know, my guess is Kevin McCarthy and Steve Scalise, they've probably been told – I was just positing this on the air. They're probably saying, hey – you know, I wouldn't be surprised, John, if somebody said, hey – the campaign finance stuff is a little sketchy here, so you'll probably have legal basis to bounce him. That's my guess. I think they're just laying low, and it's been written about that, hey, if he broke FEC laws, you know, right?
That's a whole other story. Exactly.
Yes. Jonathan Wharton, Dr. Jonathan Wharton, Associate Professor of Political Science and Urban Affairs at Southern Connecticut State University, talking about his one-time handling of some classified materials. Yes, John is an international man of mystery. See, you never knew that. John, thank you. We appreciate it. Have a wonderful day, my friend. Thank you.
Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye. All right, there you go. See? So interesting, though. Here's somebody who actually had to go through the clearance procedure. And what did he say? You get certain materials, only his, you know, different materials go to different levels of people. He didn't see, for example, what the president would see. But he said, for example, in his office or the office he worked out of in Congress, if you kept these documents for a certain time, they had to be in a relatively secure area in the office. But think about it. You're dealing with hundreds of thousands and thousands of pages.